Welcome to Polycast, the civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Ed Jim.
A very nice comment that we received. It was in response to episode 159 from Mike3640 in New York. Just wanted to thank the Polycast crew. I just got power back in my home after the hurricane, so Hurricane Sandy, and even though I hardly turn Civ on anymore, I still listen to Polycast, and in fact listen to the last bunch of casts during the mass power outages here in New York City. Thanks, guys and gals, for keeping me sane.
You're welcome.
Ooby-gooby.
Now we just need to work on keeping ourselves sane, but that's...
No,
well, that's
lose
another,
our appeal.
So.
You're just being silly, man.
Wait a minute, Phil, that assumes that we have appeal, though, because if we lose appeal, then we have appeal. So are you sure about that?
Stop trying to appeal yourself.
Well, I have all kinds of appeal. I'm not going to speak for you, though. I mean, that's up to you.
Recorded for episode 140 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian Team, Q&L, and Mega Bears Fan.
Christopher Tin, who was the composer of Civilization IV's acclaimed soundtrack, and he posted a thread saying hello. He's the guy that actually wrote Baba Yetu. He was invited to post in the Civ Fanatic forums by the mods to answer a little bit of a few questions on his new album called God of Love. So according to his post, it's not really similar to what was in the soundtrack for Civilization IV, which he composed. It's more like, he says, if you like bands like Massive Attack, Portishead, Nine Inch Nails, The Postal Service, and M83, you might find something in there that appeals to you. So it's trip-hop, synth-pop, post-punk, he says. So that's, I don't know, that sounds pretty cool. This is under his electronica duo called Stereo Alchemy. I don't know who the other person is, but I'm assuming that there's some other person there instead of him having, like, multiple personality disorder or something. So, yeah. You know, there's a lot of fans of his work, probably even before Civ, but I think he's gained a lot of new fans through the Civ community. One person asks, you know, there was no desire for another direct Grammy attempt because he won a Grammy for his soundtrack with Baba Yetu in it. And he says, yeah, I'd love to have another Grammy, but I'd probably have to get through to people like Lady Gaga and Deadmau5 to win one for this album. And I'm pretty sure they're more famous than Stereo Alchemy, so that's interesting. He answers some questions about the Civ 4 soundtrack, saying that he did a ton of research, mostly with Google and Wikipedia, I guess. And he talks about how he chose the languages that went into the album. Said he tended to choose languages that had long vocal performance traditions, like the Irish and the Maori, which is interesting.
Yeah, you know, Christopher's been very good over the last week or so. He said he's going to be hanging around CFC specifically for a couple of weeks to answer these questions, and he's staying on top of. He answers multiple questions a day, more or less, when it comes up, and he gives each one its own separate reply. And I'm not going to read the entire explanation, but probably my favorite was was North King, who asked, how did he ever get into the field of video game music composition, and even how would he recommend to, you know, another young and still wide-eyed composer how to get into it? And so Christopher said, when I was a junior in college, I did an overseas studies program in Oxford, and I shared a room with this tall Norwegian-American guy who was studying computer science and history and was a big music buff. His name was Soren Johnson.
Oh, dear. It's still all about connections.
Yes. Lord Chambers asked, are you a bit burdened by being the Baba Yetu guy everywhere you go? Is there any downside? And his response was, I don't mind being the Baba Yetu guy at all. I'm proud that I wrote that song. Is there a downside? Yes, a slight one, but it's all outweighed by all the other great things that have come my way, one way or another. Civ 4 has been the entire story of my success.
Recorded for episode 143 with Dan Q, the Mian Team, Awesome Me, and Hawk.
Rush buying sucks in Civ 4. unless you have full 100% multipliers on your gold buildings or you have Kremlin. Otherwise, it's horrible to do that. Like, just terrible. There are a couple things in Civ 4 that are worth upgrading. For example, trebuchets upgrade to cannons pretty cheaply. If you're building knight securitors, as you're pushing for cavalry, you can upgrade those pretty cheaply. Because most of your stuff is still in Hammerstead, but it allows you to get the units more quickly and deliver them more quickly after hitting your important rifling technology or steel or whatever it is.
I'd have to say, though, in Civ 5, the cost effectiveness of purchasing a unit to hurry it is like the last-ditch effort button. Like, if you click purchase a unit, unless you're so far ahead in gold that you have, like, 1,000 gold by turn, like, 100 or like 50 or like 70 or however, planning on mining resources and you're just really killing it in gold, then you purchase a unit. But upgrades, are effective, I think, in Civ 5 because it really, I think it's pretty balanced, honestly, one of the mechanics of Civ 5 in the upgrading because, it doesn't really take that much to, for example, take swordmen and upgrade to a longsword in real life. I mean, whenever I try and think about, balances of games, I try and factor in real life understandings of it and then try and apply it to the game.
You can buy, like, one unit, or you can sign, like, two or three research agreements. Isn't that nuts?
Well, yeah, I think that the research agreement, to be honest with you, I haven't played enough FFA. I've been playing a lot of teamers and duels, and I've been playing FFA with NQ, and it's a great league to play in. And Civ Flare is a great league to play in for, the 2v2s and Cetons and duels. And it's just that I found that the research agreements, they don't happen as often as you think in the multiplayer world. Unless behind in, like, your fifth and sixth in a six-player free-for-all. Do it together. Otherwise, people are adverse to, obviously, to have someone in the first place or second place give a tech lead. I think there should be tech trading, though, in Civ 5, to be honest with you.
No. That completely breaks multiplayer. I say this as a Civ 4 veteran. Tech trade, when allowed in multiplayer, it doesn't matter how skillfully you manage your empire. Nothing matters except for your relations with other empires. Is you can get like 400% post everything multipliers on your trades if you enter into a tech trading ring. And I actually think if you're talking about a free for all situation in multiplayer, in theory, research agreements should be used more often. If you're saying they're almost never used, they should probably be used more often because, okay, you're helping out one other guy and you're helping out yourself while the other four guys are falling behind. So any individual has incentive to literally sign research agreements with everyone. Now, certainly they're not going to want to do that with people that are going to be fighting or whatever, but somebody who has a bunch of research agreements versus somebody who doesn't will get ahead. And so everyone has some incentive to work the research agreements. And, you might help out number one, but if you help out yourself as well, you might be able to catch number one, or you might be able to become number one yourself.
I don't know, because it's tough.
It's a very powerful mechanic. It's not as strong as tech trades, but it's strong.
I can be honest with you, I might be ignorant about the multiplayer thing about tech trades. I guess I'll take away my opinion for it now and kind of try it out with Civ 4. I think I have old Civ 4. I'll try it out and see what it's like in multiplayer because I've just been playing multiplayer in Civ 5. And dealing with the research agreements before, I never said they're like never used. It's just that if you're going to make an agreement with a number one player, the number one player in the game, and then you're the number six player, it's going to be hard to catch up if you're actually helping them out with tech. And if he's still taking over, because he probably has a production lead on you, he's probably taking over city-states, he's probably taking over other civilizations with these tech that you're giving him, or he's teching to a science victory or a diplomatic victory or whatever it might be. And in regards to whether or not I go, like, my playing style, it's not always domination, even though it seems like it. I play a lot for sword rushes, to be honest with you, because I think that the earlier you win, the earlier the chance you have to win is the better chance you have to win. If you factor in the tech tree of it, you can't have ironworking, which usually is gone for first, because they're going to go for ironworking first because they can both produce units that are powerful. They're not just going to go companion cavalry, because if they did, they would lose. I mean, I think they would lose, because they wouldn't just produce horsemen against legions. I mean, I don't think that would be very beneficial, in your opinion, if you want to try and beat them. You want to have maybe a fortified sword in the front and kind of attack and flank the legions and drop back. Basically, turn 40 or so, we start attacking, and that allows us to attack the frontline city that they couldn't even get companion cavalry too, because you got to factor in, it takes turn 40, turn 50 to get to horseback riding and ironworking and all your luxuries and grow, so you kind of get a feel for it. So we want to just attack before then. You're playing against a person who can do the old runaround or the backstab or give something unexpected that you might not expect. Those are the games that you actually have the most fun with because you have to counter it and come up with your strategy. And you have to make sure you're flexible at the same time. I mean, even though you stick to one strategy, you have to say to yourself, what's your outs?
Recorded for episode 153 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mean Team, Majin, and Travis ATWA.
Is there a way in Civ 5 currently to manipulate their liking of other AI through espionage or something?
Well, you can snitch on them if you see things, like this person's planning on attacking you. You can at least snitch and get a little opinion boost for yourself, and obviously that might adjust the AI to not like the other person so much. But, I mean, there's the usual. Ask one of your best friends to attack a city-state that is allied to somebody else. But that doesn't always work. A lot of the times they'll say no.
I see. So there's nothing overtly broken like in Civ 4 espionage, which I personally think didn't need to be in the game, but you really, in Civ 4, you can completely break diplomacy if you want to, because you can just be like, oh, look at this nice religious group we have on the continent here. Oh, look, you have a city in Taoism, and your entire continent is Buddhist. Well, you know what? Spiritual. So now I'm Taoist, but now you're Taoist. Okay. And 5 turns later, I'm Buddhist again, and I think we should declare war on this heathen. you definitely could do that in Civ 4, and it was BS, in my opinion.
Not necessarily like the way it's implemented in Civ 4, but I do kind of miss something like that in Civ 5. Like, I think if you wanted to be a scheming kind of person where you can play the AI off of each other, you should be able to do that, and you really can't. As far as telling someone that someone is plotting against them, I mean, yeah, that makes them like them less, but so will when that person declares war in 10 turns, So it's like you really didn't make so much of a difference.
It also makes the AI that you told like you more. And it's all those little steps along the way that come out deciding where to vote. Now, of course, I mean, espionage is pretty straightforward, weak in Civ 5. I mean, I don't really like most of the mechanics in it. But it's still thin. Like, there's not much you can do. I mean, leveling up your spies is go steal the tech, which in the early game is easy, but in the later game becomes almost impossible. Or leave them in your cities and hope that the AI decides to come steal techs, except that if the AI realizes that it's really slow to go steal techs from you, they're not going to put them there. They're just going to go toss them over at city-states, which they do a lot. So you can't really level up your spies very well. There's tech stealing is stupid. There, I said it. Tech stealing is stupid.
Recorded for episode 155 with Dan Q, Makalua, Majin, Liz Burst, and Quantum Tarantino.
Earlier in the chat, with regards to Kickstarter, Y even says, we'll see them get funded, but will we see them get made? And I had said in the chat, if they're not made, with regards to Kickstarter, should get the money refunded, though indeed not necessarily. The idea being that there are many more investors investing less each than a few, i.e. corporations investing a lot. They'll still very much leading up to, an initial release. And then Y even said, well, wasn't meaning that people getting funded by Kickstarter might take the money and run, although I'm sure a few of those do exist. Yeah. More like people not needing to deliver on the quality part. They only have to make something with the money, even if they phone it in and in the end say, well, sorry, we tried really, really hard. And I think that's a risk that those individual investors are taking, just like the big investors are. So you don't just take at face value what they're saying on Kickstarter. Ooh, someone started a webpage that says they're going to make a game. Okay, who are you? Now I'm going to do a little research in a search engine to see if I can find out who are you. What are your credentials? What's your experience? What's your background? I can't find it. You tell me, and then you substantiate it, because I may be an investor that's only thinking about investing $50 instead of $500,000, but that $50 or $100 is like that $500,000 to a substantial company, so convince me. And it's true that even with the best experience in the world and all of the background and everything all lined up in a row, you can still get crap Just like you can get someone that just has this idea, no experience, no background, and it's a runaway hit.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's one of those, on balance, at the time, was it a good idea? If you reflect back on it and say, given everything that I knew, was this a reasonable investment? And of course, if you're going to invest in this, if you need that $50 for rent money this month, then you shouldn't be investing the $50, yeah, even if it's going to work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you're not investing.
I'm contributing to the Wasteland 2 Kickstarter, which looks like that's going to go, because that's actually people who work on game support, and we're involved in making the Fallout game, so they know what the hell they're doing.
Tim Schafer's Kickstarter.
Oh, yeah, Tim Schafer. Yeah, yeah, I've already put money in that. I've invested. But, yeah, of course, I'm going to get the game out of it. I'm not going to get money out of it, which the corporation would, but that's another matter altogether.
Right.
But you have to watch out, though, on the corporate versus Kickstarter type bash, because I know plenty of development houses that, as much as publishers say, here's a few million dollars, please work on this, and by the way, you have to show us what you're doing every once in a while. A lot of those development houses have little issues where people just say, well, we'll call this alpha for now, and it's not. So sometimes even the big companies spend money on development houses and find out that they probably should have used somebody else.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, yeah.
Or it'd be like, yeah, whatever, just push back the schedule. Like, no, we're actually releasing on this date. Yeah, whatever.
Well, we told Walmart that.
Well, it's more the investor side of things, because most of the big game companies are now, well, most, four of them left? Soon to be three, maybe two, for the publisher side of things. They're all public. So they have to do SEC filings and all that stuff. So if they say they're going to release a product on X date, investors kind of get pissy when it doesn't happen. Because investors at the high level are paying for stuff to make them money.
Yeah, that's what just happened to THQ.
Mm. Pretty much.
But Blizzard for years have been, you know, running their own policy of when it's done. And they've had flack for that and everything. But really, I mean, they have a loyal fan base of a couple of million people that will buy anything they give out because they know it's quality. I wouldn't say the same for Firaxis, I'm sorry.
Blizzard built the reputation of, we'll produce a good game so you'll get it when you get it, and therefore they were able to get away with that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Whereas, yeah, I would not take some other development company, and that's not specific to Firaxis. That's like, I wouldn't take anything Ubisoft gives me.
Yeah.
As a recommendation on quality, nothing at Ubisoft counts as well.
That's the thing. You gotta make a stand on where you are in the whole customer relationship thing. And if you're in the, well, we'll sell you something, and if you don't like it, well, too bad, you know, or if it's crap, too bad, you paid for it, man. You can say it might be a bad idea to invest in a Kickstarter project. It might turn out to be a great game. You might buy a shit game and realize that, you know, this sucks, or, you know, it's buggy or whatever. That happens. Or it used to happen in the olden days, you know, when you saw a game like, oh, that was cool, let's try it out. And you had no idea what it was and it turned out to be either awesome or crap. You have the suckiest game in the world and someone's like, oh, that's pretty good. That's the worst. I mean, the same with movies.
They get 20% positive for some reason.
It's not 100% that sucks. Somebody liked it.
Yeah.
Recorded for episode 160 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Me and Team, Mad Shin, and Monthar.
Soren choosing the soundtrack for Civ 4, which I found interesting. And reading through this, he basically said he initially went for pieces that he himself liked, but then realized that they didn't work very well in the strategy game because they, you know, they didn't mesh well with playing out your turns, for example. They added these climaxes and it just, you know, it didn't sound right. So he started moving more towards other things like dance music or middle movements of larger, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, he left in a Bach piece just because he liked it so much. And I liked the Civ 4 music. I didn't have a problem with it at all, except for maybe very late-era stuff, especially in Beyond the Sword, got a little dull. I think we just needed more pieces in some of the ages because they tended to last a long time. But you could always put your own soundtrack into Civ 4.
Soren decided to share these answers as he was asked them by a master student in music at Texas Christian University, Kyle Roderick. And you mentioned in some areas there, Phil, perhaps having desiring a greater selection. And Roderick asked a question specifically in respect to that with regards to the modern era. Why was only American composer John Adams chosen, and were other composers considered? And Soren said, quote, "The repertoire from modern period is much more varied than of any other eras, which meant that finding a consistent style and tone would be difficult. Furthermore, the chaotic structure and casual dissonance of much of modern music would be a difficult match for the mainstream audience of Civ. By using only Adams, I was able to maintain stylistic consistency for the era while also finding a palatable way to stay true to the stylistic innovations of the periods." Unquote. Wow. That's
See, I disagree with that. Why not just add some variety? As long as each individual piece isn't, like, completely inappropriate for the game. I don't see how that would have hurt things. I think that would have made it better, honestly. But, you know, it's not a big deal. I can't really come down on him for his decision with the music. And a lot of the music in Civ 4 was just great, so whatever.
Besides modern era, when you start getting into that.
Besides modern era. He dropped the ball in modern era.
Yeah, well,
but,
no.
You know, anything that you listen to for, like, 2-3 years playing the game, you eventually, like, you know what? I'm going to use my own soundtrack now. Because,
yeah.
Well, no, but that's the point. I think that's more my point. Modern era comes with, oh, I need to go license that music. Now who do I have to pay?
Yes.
And once you start having to pay people, even for a brief amount, it stops being cheap to use. Whereas everything before that point is all free. Well, mostly.
Yeah, most of the classical stuff is public domain, and they even just how much of the budget in Rockstar Games goes to towards licensing all the music. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. They could take the EA approach and go for less known people who just want to get their name out there.
It's interesting that you brought that up, Magin, and actually your further comment just now there, Phil. Second part of his answer to that question was, I would also like to add that I will always be grateful to whoever at 2K actually approved my request to include so much John Adams. The price was not low.
Oh.
I was somewhat expecting them to balk at it, and I'm glad they supported me.
Well, then.
Okay.
And he also says, I have similar feelings for them approving Velvet Underground's Rock and Roll as the background piece for the Rock and Roll Wonder. So many other cheaper or more expensive paths could have given that moment a very cliched tone.
Oh, yeah. You mean they shouldn't put the Beatles in there?
Yeah.
But in the Civ community, well, specifically on Civ Fanatics anyway, there hasn't been a lot of conversation about this in the forums, but a couple of people have pounced on part of his answer to the very last question, which was, if you could go back and change something about the soundtrack to Civilization IV, what would you change and why? He talks about he's quite proud of how the soundtrack turned out, and I certainly would never dream that Baba Yetu, Civ IV's theme, would win a Grammy, vanilla Civ IV's theme, I should say, to be more specific. You know, he also wishes that my musical knowledge would have been deeper and wider so I could have built a more varied selection. However, if I was to design another Civ game, and at that point people just went, what, Soren, are you teasing us? That's not very nice.
It's the hypothetical people getting so excited.
He's not coming back.
If I was, it would be extremely difficult to go through the process over again and force myself to pick new pieces. I do view the soundtrack of Civ 4 as a piece of myself that sits inside the game, an enthusiastic jumble of my passions and my happenstances. Ooh.
You know what he should have done? It would have been hilarious with how popular rifles and cavalry became in the game. Completely ruin the Renaissance soundtrack. Just make it play Nyan Cat the entire frickin' time and spray it out of there.
Cavalry now. Yeah.
That was not adorable, but apparently there is something that's too adorable to do something to.
Oh, God, not the furry. What do I get frolicking furries as a comment? So apparently Magma Dragon wanted, or Dragoon wanted to troll the forums. I'm just going to take it at that rather than them being real requesting this. So they like how the foxes frolic and play in their glen. They're so cute. Can't bring himself to put a camp on these little guys knowing they will be killed. Please replace them with a less adorable graphic. Okay, how about a less adorable graphic is them getting bashed over the head as they frolic?
don't think that's the kind of less adorable he's going for.
Well, it would be less adorable.
Just like clubbing seals. I don't see what the big deal is.
Yeah, the cuter it is, the tastier it is. What's the problem?
As Black Catatonic in the thread says, they are cute, but I'd rather have unhappy foxes than unhappy people.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's random commentary all through this. Mostly it's the question of, are foxes cute or not?
Well, my first thought when I read this thread was what post 7 here, Panky, just think of it as building them nice warm tents to live in. The fur resource is actually cute pet foxes for everyone.
Yeah. So there you go. There you built them a little house. Now you can give pets that people can shave themselves and put on their own clothes.
Just getting a better place. They're going to a better place. That's all. Yes, that's all that's happening.
Better place.
A few final points for me on this thread. Number one, Monthar mentioned Panky. He was a guest on episode 156 of Polycast from earlier this season. Sukritak says people are feeling compassion for bits and pixels. And General So says, no, you have it all wrong. They just catch them and sell them as pets. How's your little pony doing?
No, not bronies.
No, not bronies, Fred. That.
No point for you.
Play into the Civ forums now. Oh man!
Yeah. Oh no, there's a mod.
It's everywhere.
Somebody made a mod. Added Brony.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
And now you made me remember again. Why? Yep. Why would you do that? Just because I played in one game of Mafia as Rainbow Dash. Best Civ intro.
Whoa, stop. That's favorite Civ intro. Not necessarily best. I'm just, you know, I'm being nitpicky.
Nope. Best. Because it's favorite. It's my favorite, which means it's the best.
But it might not necessarily be the favorite of everybody, so therefore it wouldn't be their best. So it's their favorite.
That's relevant, Dan. I don't know why you're bringing that up. It doesn't er.
Did you say it doesn't er? Or did you just cut out badly and it sounded like you said a word that doesn't...
It doesn't matter.
Oh. Okay.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I like that word.
It doesn't matter.
I forgot to say it anymore. Well, this third is a poll on it, which is likely why our esteemed co-host selected it for us. And it is a vote on which of the Civ intros is your favorite, with the landslide going to Civ 4 Vanilla.
Something
new about
way.
That Grammy piece, I guess, but... Yeah, second place is Civ 4 Beyond the Sword, and then Civ 5 is third. So, how about that?
They cheated because there's no gods and kings.
He says that Dr. Fives, who started the thread, said, I've missed some likely add-ons. Please let me know if so. I don't think there was any change in themes for any of the add-ons that were not mentioned here. Like Civilization 2, there was conflicts in Civilization and Fantastic Worlds and Multiplayer Gold Edition. And yes, I remembered all of that without having to look it up. Oh my gosh. He says that, yes, I missed Civilization Revolution for a start. Well, you could say that this is just about PC-based Civ titles, I suppose. He says, oh, and colonization. I guess he must mean Civilization IV colonization. Well,
it's a different game, so it's not even a Civ series game.
Well, he was using the Civ 4 engine, but it's...
But not the Civ 4 game.
No, it's a self-contained entity. So, you know, you didn't mess up there, Dr. Fives. That's okay.
Just gods and kings. Totally whiffed on that one.
So Civ 4 Vanilla wins because it's music, basically. That's the conclusion on his poll.
Yeah, but the video sucked.
A lot of them are impressive videos, though. Well, okay, and Civ's not a game about its videos, so... Unless you're Let's Playing, of course. But aside from that...
Yeah, because it was about your favorite Civ intro, so I guess some people could actually look more at the video than the music, and then perhaps not have voted for Baba Yetu that way. If I was voting for the video, I'm actually kind of, although I have a soft spot for first Civilization, because it was the first Civilization I played, I would actually say my favorite Civ video intro is what's not included on this poll in part, and that's Civilization Revolution.
It's pretty crappy.
Oh, I think your assessment is pretty crappy, so there. You're wrong.
I've seen it too many times.
Are you saying that the intro to Civ Rev is crappy, Majin?
Yeah.
Or are you stating the obvious?
No. Just that the intro is.
Okay. Just making sure, I've never played it, so I actually can't say one way or another. I'm just being a bit of an ass, but, yeah.
Okay, I like Gods and Kings better. I mean, how often do we get to burn people at the cross?
Today.
Yay.
recorded for episode 159 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mean Team, Mad Jin, and Kaya.
More Pantheon beliefs, and most of the suggestions for more Pantheon beliefs actually came from people other than who started the thread, which was Omnipotent 42. I'm actually more interested in this thread about what the thread became more about, which was suggesting other Pantheon beliefs, which I assume are meant to be more in addition to the ones that are already there, as opposed to substituting any.
As much as there's a list of Pantheon beliefs, it's always nice to find out a lot more. So if there's other ideas, yes, more choices is always more better, but that doesn't necessarily mean the suggestions are any good.
So what I did, because I'm crazy, I mean, you already knew that, but I thought I'd just put that out there.
You didn't start a poll, did you?
No. Mackie, no, I don't start polls. What I did is I broke down the type of suggestion of Pantheon into, I tried to categorize what was being suggested by several people, including the same posters several times. Either a combination of effects, culture-based, faith-based, food-based, science-based, unit-based, or in one case, an other. And of course, a combination would be two or more of any of the other headings. Let's start with Chinook Blessings. Minus one movement in Tundra and Plains tiles, plus one faith in Tundra and Plains tiles. Wait. I thought that these were about giving us something. It's about making a choice, yes, but it's about making a choice of choosing one Pantheon over another, as opposed to, here's a penalty for actually choosing that. What?
Is the minus one actually meant as plus one or something?
It was expressed as minus one, and if it's plus one movement as well as plus one faith, I think that's a bit much.
That would fall into the OP category.
And besides, don't we already have one where you get
plus one faith on Tundra without forest?
We already have that substantially covered anyway. But I really got hung up on this minus one movement. Like, seriously? I think that's going against the whole idea behind a Pantheon, in part.
Yeah, because that sounded like something more that they would want the plus one, not the minus one. You worship the stuff that's in the Tundra, therefore you have a better feel for the Tundra, and you move faster.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Oh, I'm sorry, posters are not supposed to make sense, what?
Yeah.
This one is like, oh my god, it's so open to abuse and annoyance all at the same time. Cycles of the Earth. Every new era, you must switch Pantheon beliefs with another civilization's Pantheon.
No. I'm vetoing that in advance. That's just dumb.
Dum-de-dum-dum.
Oh, and there's a supplement to this one. This is why it's a combo. Ancient Era Pantheon Effect. Plus one faith per turn for Empire. I don't really see the connection between the two. And, again, we have other examples of plus one faith or whatever, but it usually has to be tied to something situational.
Plus one faith, period, just sucks.
Yeah.
like every other Pantheon belief is better than that.
Feeding the Gods. I actually like the titles of most of these in the case, by the way. Farms improve tile by plus one faith rather than plus one food, where subsequent technologies improve the faith yield, not the food.
Hi, we have lots of faith, but we can't breed.
So, in other words, it would be nice to be able to work that tile, but... or you have to wait in order to get additional technologies to get buildings that will increase your food in order to be able to actually work that tile.
But there's not that many of them.
Oh, dear. God of Justice. Courthouses produce plus one culture and plus one faith. Oh.
That's it? That's a pretty bad Pantheon.
So in other words, you have to have cities that you have annexed in order to be able to use this, number one.
I was in there thinking, wait a minute.
Oh, I'm fine with a bonus that ties to annexing cities and putting courthouses in. I'm fine with that. It's just that option is really low because it's going to happen very low amount of time. Like, you know, there's situational and then there's like micro situational.
But those five cities you annexed compared to the 20 others that are part of your empire.
Yeah.
God of Merchants. The further a city is from the capital and connected to the capital, gives it a percentage modifier to gold and faith. 1, 10% gold and 2 12% faith, I'm thinking, first off, okay, I have more questions than I have an answer, because the farther a city is from the capital and connected, it gives a percentage modifier to gold and faith. So does that mean that the modifier is greater or less than when it gets farther away or closer? And 10% gold and 12% faith, so it's a percentage base. And to me, a pantheon is about giving you a nice little boost in the immediate game until hopefully you get a religion. So when it's a percentage based, and if you're only producing, you know, one or two faith a turn, you're really not going to be able to realize that.
Yeah, well, realizing it in the late game, I think that's part of the point. Percentage boosts and pantheons are basically going to give you superpowers in the late game, but that's not very good. None of the pantheon beliefs really give you, like, huge amounts. There should only be a few, depending on how many cities you have or the special stuff. But even the special stuff is finite. Whereas if you do start giving percentages, then 10% gold, if it's 10% gold, if it's, you know, three tiles away, and 100% gold, if you're, you know, half a world away, well, then I'll just go drop a city over there, TP the whole thing and watch the place go.
And listeners, yes, that's trading posting things, not toilet papering them.
Somebody's there, so you might want to TP their houses, take it, and then put it in.
Or you could toilet paper the trading post, and then you could TP. Completely random thought, obviously. Moving on quickly to save us all. Holy Inundation, +1 culture and +1 faith on floodplains and marshes.
The one thing that purposely got kicked out of all other bonuses when they got added, because floodplains and marshes can be overpowered. Yeah, that's great. Dutch, Polder.
Yeah.
Floodplains, marshes. Adding stuff to that, really bad. And then on the opposite side, Desert, Faye, Petra, and a whole bunch of other stuff purposely left off floodplains, because floodplain is basically just a grassland. So mass farming on that is still massive in the middle of a desert. So I think there was a reason why floodplains and marshes got left off the list of pantheon beliefs.
Holy Mountain, +1 faith and +1 happiness for mountains. Let's go to a mountain cluster and, there's some other tiles nearby so that I can grow and, you know, get my granary in there. And hey, look at all the +1 faith and +1 happiness I'm getting from mountains. Too OP.
Actually, it's kind of useless. Because the mountain has no other tile bonus. So you would only get +1 faith and +1 culture. I'm assuming that you have to work the mountains, not that just, you know, they're next to you. Or did I assume that backwards?
That would buff natural wonders, though.
Yeah, that too. Too many of them are mountain-based.
Yeah.
Disagreement there. Mortuary cults. For every citizen growth, add +1 faith-based production to the city.
It's not horrible. It means that tall empires actually get good faith output.
It's okay. Goddess of Love. Should tie it to that there so then it wouldn't be quite so overpowering in the early game.
Or, you know, one for every 10. Kind of like aristocracy. So one faith for every 10 pop.
Yeah. Raising Cities provides faith and double gold from Order of Chaos.
Yeah.
Okay.
No?
Except for the double gold part. Just because.
Yeah, combining it
double
with,
song highs triple.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, that would just be.
The one from culture that's only culture, God of Wisdom. Scientific buildings produce +1 culture. I don't have an issue with that.
Whatever. I mean, there is, but library, university, public school, observatory, research lab. So you can stack up an extra 5 per city, depending on observatories, of course.
It's not like something you can get really early on in the game, either.
Yeah.
All of those things combined.
Well, no, but it's the eventual. Both have to look at the initial library gives you the +1 versus the, okay, now that we're done, how much am I going to really get out of it? And that's not much more than some other stuff. So that wouldn't be horrible.
Looking in the chat, Monthar said earlier about +1 faith from mountains. I can understand adding gems to that pantheon since religious idols did include gems with the gold and silver, but were never made of salt, and I don't recall any made of copper.
Well, I'm sure there's some religious idols made out of copper, at least when copper came out, because it was new and it was special and it was, you know, mystical.
Shiny.
Salt, yeah, I can agree with that.
Salt, yeah. Don't leave it out in the rain.
Yeah.
Our religious idols are melting.
Sign from the gods, you all suck.
The rain god hates you.
Food, center of the world. When another city grows, minus 20% chance it raises the capital's population rather than that city's. I'm really trying to wrap my head around how this works. Besides being the random, you know, there's just a minus 20% chance. So in other words, there's a 20% less chance. I think, don't they mean there's a 20% chance that it will raise the capital's population rather than the city's? And I'm assuming then, of course, that center of the world, how would that work in the capital itself then? It seems like we're missing some things for it to make sense to me. Elemental worship, plus one food base in city.
That's underwhelming.
Well, it's half of a population, half of a granary.
Yeah, I think it's okay.
It's basically equal to the ally bonus of a mercantile city-state for all of the other cities other than your capital.
Yeah, but if you have, what's it called, the one that fertility rights, if you have this one already, why would you discard the 10% in favor of just playing one straight-up food?
Well, it depends on how much, if you're trying to grow or not. If you're generating less than 10 food, then 10% is not one. And if you're generating no food, then 10% is nothing.
10% of nothing is nothing.
Yeah, but you'd still get that plus one. And that plus one, summed up with other stuff, might end up, you know, letting you work something that you wouldn't normally work, like a plains horse. Because, you know, the one from the plains plus the one from the city equals the two food for the worker. Or another specialist or something. There's points in there. Yeah, fertility rights is probably better, especially when you're trying to grow, especially early. But eventually that plus could work out if you're not trying to grow anymore.
Forgiveness. Clearing a barbarian camp grants a one-off bonus amount of food towards population growth in the nearest city. Scales with era.
Forgiveness?
That's what it's called. I don't know why, but...
We have decided to chop up your family, giving us a nice food bonus. Please forgive us for eating.
I mean, clearing a barbarian camp, there's already that tied to a city-state request, for example. Plus that if you're even going to do this, would there not then need to be a limit, perhaps how far away the camp can be in order to even gain that boost?
Yeah.
I know gameplay and realism, but I know that's a bit more of a side consideration, but I don't like the feel of that one.
The rune that gives you plus one pop in the nearest city, you could pop that in the middle of the other side of the planet, and you'd still get it back in your capital if your capital was the only city in existence for you. So, not sure the argument on the food side really matters, because we already have that mechanic for an entire population point. But it just seems more like cannibalism.
So that would be a odd pantheon.
Called forgiveness. Please forgive us as we eat you.
Science, god of wisdom. Shrines and temples each grant one science. Okay. And one scientist specialist slot. No?
Hells no.
That sounds a little low-key to me.
Just a wee bit.
Don't you remember when the libraries used to give us great scientist specialists?
They make that even earlier.
It's like hitting pantheon. Warriors have 15 strength.
Units, dark magic. May cause a loss of last promotion earned when you attack.
Why?
Why would you even want that?
I'm going to fool my enemy into thinking I'm using logic in this game. I take dark magic. What?
No, maybe he means that the enemy would lose their promotion.
Even that would be kind of since the AI tends to use insta-heal.
And that does seem cheesy as well.
Well, you lose it. You lose your insta-heal.
Ha ha! No.
What does that damage them if they lose the insta-heal?
Yeah, well.
You healed off 10 hit points. Are you healed off 8 hit points before, or 80 now? Well, you lose 80 hit points instantly on attacking me.
I actually prefer that you lose all of your promotions, let alone your last promotion, when you attack and you die, or your attack and you died. How about that? How about we just keep that?
You pretty much lose all your promotions when you die. Yeah.
Yeah. See, that's I'm good with that. It works in gameplay and is also realistic. Ooh. Demigods, ranged and melee units receive plus 5% combat strength. That seems anemic.
Let's see.
25%.
You'd have to be level 20 ranged combat strength before that 5% matters. That's into the Renaissance.
Yeah. We'd like it to our pantheon beliefs to have at least some kind of benefit in the early game, as well as perhaps something incremental going on towards the middle and later part of the game. Well, not so much the later part of the game, but the middle part of the game, I should say. God of Creation, tile improvement, construction speed increased by 15%. Yeah, isn't there a social policy that really kind of addresses this already?
End of pyramid.
And that too.
And both of them are better.
Yes.
And I don't think 15% worked the numbers. Actually, I think it has to be by 25% or something, because just the way that the number of turns for certain tile improvements goes, I don't think 15% would even take off one turn when it comes to certain improvements. So therefore, it would be useless.
God of Frost, units produced in these cities gain a promotion. Raising a tile turns the terrain beneath to snow. So I think what they're saying is units produced in a city that has been built on snow would then mean that if they raise a tile, then the terrain beneath it turns to snow? Sounds a little fantastical. Is that a word?
Yeah. Well, obviously the whole section of his post is all fantasy stuff. He wants a fantasy mod.
And it's a little bit terraforming, too.
Yeah.
Mythical Beasts. Mounted units receive plus 10% combat strength.
Okay.
Sacred Legends. Plus 10% combat strength on friendly territory until the Renaissance era.
Seems kind of minimally useless.
Kind of overlapping a bit with some... is it Enhancer Belief? Or Follower Belief?
There's a few in there. There's some enhancers that give you bonuses, 20% bonuses. Near cities, there's like a whole social policy and order. There's a certain thing called a wonder. there's a few, and something that just dies off in the Renaissance just doesn't make sense to me as a belief.
Wraiths of Pestilence, which of course makes me think of Stargate, which is science fiction, which is a good thing.
All right.
When attacking, may cause disease promotion, a 10% chance. The disease promotion causes minus 10 hit points per turn and spreads to friendly adjacent units at the end of the turn. So is that like minus 10% hit points in perpetuity? Or is it just, I hope that would just be a one-off, but still, a disease promotion?
That's in perpetuity? Like instantly you'll wipe out your entire army and your neighbor's army? And did you know that you can gift units to other people?
Oh.
Hi, you just gave me disease. Yeah, here you go. You can have the unit now. Bye. Hey, look, nice now no one has units.
Goddess of Volcanoes. Mountains within the city radius may turn volcanic, raising tile improvements. Afterwards, tiles have additional plus one food.
Why would you want that? It's totally going to hit a floodplain, and then the plus one food is not going to matter.
Creation Myth. Receive faith when you found a city. What?
Huh?
No.
Why not? Depends on how much faith.
It's an AI one right there.
There's so many other ways to receive faith, and seeing as how, you know, settling...
What?
But founding a city just seems to be a common thing to do anyway. That just seems too basic.
Depends on how much faith.
I don't care if it's even just one faith or 10%. I don't care. Just, no. Divination. X percentage base faith is also converted to science. Also converted?
What else is it doing?
No.
It's also being converted to hammers, Majin, just so you know.
Oh, okay. As long as it's being converted to hammers and speakers.
Absolutely. Okay, what more could you ask for? Gold. Oh, culture, too, I guess.
Gold culture.
Yeah, gold hammers, science, and culture. There we go.
Population. Go forth and multiply. So faith should be turned into population.
Yeah, there you go. It just makes everything.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny. You know, there actually was a suggested pantheon in this thread called Go Forth and Multiply. I'm not kidding. I'll jump ahead to that since you said it. Settlers built in adherent cities instantly spread their religion to any new cities they found. No.
What?
Why would you try to take away from our missionaries in particular? Now, that makes it too easy.
Oh, yeah, I automatically get a pantheon for every city that you found, as long as you didn't found a religion.
Well, you see, that's the way it's phrased, is it spread their religion, so this really shouldn't be a pantheon belief.
I don't know. I think it's right. Settlers didn't just randomly forget them, so their religion, you know?
Yeah, but that would break the mechanic of struggling to spread your religion, in a way.
Not really. It'll get there eventually.
Well, yeah, get there eventually, as opposed to instantly.
Yeah.
I still think it works, but I think the cities should not be the ones producing the religious pressure. But that's just me.
Exiles of Return. Allied city-states produce missionaries every so many turns for you. maybe if they were allied city-states who have adopted your religion, and then I assume by produced missionaries, then means it's like it gives you a unit, and so then it says, here you go. Maybe if you adopted the religion, and if the missionary appeared in the city-state, then if you thought you wanted to use it, then you would have to either hope that it didn't get attacked and captured, or you'd have to try to find a way to escort it. I'm starting to think of a way to make it work, and then I'm thinking, oh my gosh, it's either going to be too good to be true, or then it's maybe becoming a little bit too much effort to be bothered.
I have a question. Do you still get the missionary if you haven't even founded a religion?
Again, it's not as a pantheon, is it? Yeah, there's a bit of an issue there with that as well. God of riches, plus one faith on mines. No.
Yeah.
But why not?
Why not? Was that a serious question?
No.
Okay. God of the wild, unimproved tiles give plus three faith. Oh, go, 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 go.
There's lots of unimproved tiles if you don't want
no.
it. See, I'm not going to improve that mountain. I'm not going to improve that natural wonder.
I'm just not going to improve anything, and then I'll have this faith-based empire, and I can crush you with all the warriors I buy through faith.
Or, hey, look, I didn't actually build a worker for the first half of the game, but you know what? It's great in enhancing your religion on turn 30.
Goddess of the arts, cultural buildings produce plus one faith.
There's already some stuff like that. Like, there's follower beliefs that, you know, give faith from certain culture buildings, but are even more limited. Like, amphitheaters providing plus two faith, but only if it's in a city with five followers. No. Pantheon being more powerful than a follower belief seems a bad idea.
Holy relic, receive a large sum of faith as opposed to a long-term benefit. Well, I think that would also be a long-term benefit, but don't we already have, you know, the religious community, ancient ruin, that kind of gives us that, and we have an issue with that. Like, receive a large sum of faith, that's also a very general term, but just...
I spent 20 faith to get my first pantheon, or as the Celts, I've spent all of 10 faith by not doing anything to get my pantheon. I shall take 200 faith to get a great profit. Thank you, pantheon.
And then you've got another city, and that pantheon spreads. Then you receive another large sum, and then another large sum, and oh, whoa. Mercenaries of the gods, when capturing cities with foreign pantheons, they may keep their effects even after your religion spreads to them. No, we're trying to get to a trade-off situation here.
What? They keep their what? If there's somebody of a different religion?
Yes, when capturing cities with foreign pantheons, they may keep their effects even after your religion spreads to them. And I assume that means spreads to them, meaning that, because you can have, like, shared spread, right? It's not an all and absolute. But I think what they're saying is that if and when the religion takes over a foreign city that you've captured, whatever their pantheon belief was, then they keep that too, in addition to now the benefits that you are giving the city.
Eh, not sure that's a pantheon belief, but it'd be more of a follower or enhancer belief, or maybe even founder.
I think it's too much.
Or a social policy. Or a wonder. That's not a pantheon belief.
Offerings to the gods, plus one faith for every four citizens. I assume that means plus one faith for every four citizens in a city, just to finish the thought.
Or just every four citizens.
I'm okay with that.
No, I'd rather per follower or something. Or per city. Again, White Empire, 200 population, that's plus 50 faith per turn.
Patron gods, cities produce plus two faith.
Mm.
Just because it's a city?
That's a little too good.
Yeah. Oh, sacred chants. Percentage faith is also converted to culture. And again, that also word.
Love the elsas.
Besides, we have this, you know, we have that tied to, you know, technologies already as well, you know, like to build wealth, science, culture. So let's just leave it out of the pantheons anyway. So three more. Sacred connections. 10% faith generation for you and your friend when signing a declaration of friendship.
So just sign declarations of friendships with everybody, let them run out, sign it again, and you constantly get lots of random crap for doing nothing.
You see, I'd interpreted that as 10% faith generation for once you sign the declaration of friendship, you're getting that for the duration of the friendship, which would be even more extreme, considering how long declaration of friendship lasts. But yes. Spirits of nature, plus one faith for every seven tiles under your control. Seven, huh?
Is there that would... seven?
I don't know what the significance
is. Seven is a great number, I guess. That won't get abused, not at all.
And finally... Will-O-the-Wisp worship. Will-o'-the-Wisp Worship. I had to try to say that 3 times, even though it wasn't that fast. Killing a barbarian on Entile increases its yield by +1 faith. I'm thinking, what, in perpetuity?
Yeah, so convert barbs to faith. Basically,
lower the barbs to your floodplains repeatedly.
Wait a minute, doesn't that also overlap on a unique ability of a civ?
Killing for faith?
Yeah, that one. The Celts?
Yeah, the unit. The Pictish warrior.
Maybe the final word on this topic can go to Monthar, which we've kind of reflected as well, in a sense. Sounds like to me some of these folks want pantheons that are as powerful as the founder beliefs.
Pretty much.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 441-21-288-7659. That's 441-21-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Recorded during episode 142.
To be honest, I would trade any feature, any expansion feature in either Civ 4 or Civ 5, or even some of the base features in the games, to just get the game running more smoothly. And that means no out-of-sync problems in multiplayer. You can actually have up to 8 or 9 people in multiplayer without it being problematic. And when you hit end turn, you don't spend more time waiting for your next turn than you do playing your turns. You know, or, you know, you give a unit an order and it moves immediately, and you can immediately cycle to the next order if you choose to skip animations. You don't have to wait all the time. It's something that's been a big sticking point for me in the Civ series, and it's something that adds up over time, certainly. When you have 30-second turn times, you play a couple hundred turns, you are going to be spending hours waiting. And that's a lot of people miss that. And they don't notice it because they either play slowly through a typical game. You know, it's a lot different for someone playing a 3-hour game versus a 20-hour game. But for a good portion of the casual audience, you're looking at less than 10-hour games, and then the turn times become very substantial. And that, you know, I would trade away any feature in the game to get that running smoothly, any of them.
As part of the PC Gamer interview with lead designer Ed Beach, and this was in the context of multiplayer, but it was, we've had some of our senior engineers on the project dedicated to hitting some of these items. The gameplay processing and graphics processing have been threaded out from each other, and that's helping with multiplayer stability. So if that's helping out with multiplayer stability, then hopefully there's also that transfer to single-player stability, and we get some faster turn times as a result.
Recorded during episode 144.
I really think that in order for the whole one unit per tile thing to actually work well, you have to have bigger backs, lots bigger. But there's just no way to do that without melting your processor.
Exactly. The game lags enough now and takes up resources. If we make the maps larger, that's just going to make it worse, guys.
Yeah.
There's a way, but it involves fixing the engine first.
Yeah, so there's a kind of a, I don't know, it's a catch-22 kind of thing. The one aspect of the game would work better if there were bigger maps, but if there were bigger maps, the game wouldn't work. So
your argument is cart before the horse?
Yeah, at least be fixing the wheels on the cart before you try to upgrade the horse.
Yeah, all right, let's fix the wheels first. I agree with that. Let's do that.
Unfortunately, they're not fixing the wheels on this cart. Shoot.
Like, no, the car is fine. We're just going to make the horse prettier.
Yeah, that's what they've been doing. They've been painting the horse.
Give it a good brushing, yes.
I'm waiting for the upgrade on the horse to the helicopter.
Helicopter pulled cart.
It would go faster, that's true.
And everything would fall out of it.
It might not even matter anymore.
It just goes faster. That's all you need to know. It goes faster. Forget about the side effects. Who cares about side effects?
Yeah, it goes faster downwards.
The cart drags it down.
But it's more power. How can you argue with more power? You can't argue with more power.
So the helicopter crashed. Did this come as a surprise to you? Well, it certainly did to the pilots.
Well, that kind of went a little morbid there.
Yeah.
It's like, whoa, wait a minute. We're trying to have fun here, John. What are you doing?
I mean... Look, we've all enjoyed committing genocide in Civ. Let's be morbid. I think it's part of our nature. At least, you know, a bit, gallows humor. That's all.
Recorded during episode 138.
Is there a swimsuit edition?
You know what? I'm not going to answer that question. I don't want to think about your question. Yeah, period.
It's the most popular edition of Illustrated, so, yeah.
That doesn't always translate well across contexts, unless we are being very selective about inclusions for that swimsuit edition.
What is wrong with Peter being in a swimsuit, other than the question?
If you don't know, then I'm not going to tell you.
What's sad is it could be worse, too.
That's true.
Dan, would you like a brain eraser?
Are you willing me to loan yours, Maggie?
I probably need to send you a shipment of brain bleach, too, right?
With a minty fresh smell.
Record date assorted 2012. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.